The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, the last show of the week. Thank you for joining us today. Keep sending us that feedback. Send those emails to td@kpcg.fm. Well, a little bit more on the Brussels attack from Tuesday. Quite a bit more information continues to roll in. Evidently, the attack had been planned for Easter Monday, but then it was brought forward a few days due to that arrest on Friday, I guess it was last week, when they finally got the suspect who was behind the Paris attacks in November. So as I highlighted yesterday, I mean, it shows how that they can pretty much strike at will whenever they want, wherever they want. There was another big attack foiled just last night in and around Paris once again, a plot that was supposedly in its advanced stages. And now there's reports coming along as well talking about multiple additional plots by ISIS all across Europe and with terror cells linked to the Paris and the Brussels networks that brought on those attacks, Brussels this week, Paris in November. And they've also, of course, discovered a fair bit of information in the apartments that they've raided, including maps and other potential targets. In Belgium, six people now have been arrested. The police are finally getting busy. And it emerged yesterday that the brothers that were involved in this most recent attack, that they were also, I guess, monitoring a nuclear scientist, indicating that they may have been trying to target some kind of nuclear facility across the continent. There's been quite a few stories, too, about Molenbeek, this suburb of Brussels, this hotbed of radicalism. If you look at Belgium as a whole, I talked about the proportion yesterday. It's just a small nation of 11 million people. And that small nation has sent upwards of 400, perhaps close to 500 Islamists to fight on behalf of ISIS, either in Syria or Iraq. And that's the highest per capita in Europe for such a small nation to send almost 500 fighters to the Middle East to fight alongside ISIS. And then what happens when they return home? Well, again, talking about Molenbeek, this is a bit from Legal Insurrection, the website. It says the troubles for Molenbeek began under the administration of district's socialist mayor, Philippe Moreau, who ruled from 92 to 2012. Under his reign, the law and order collapsed and businesses fled the district, unable to cope with rising crime. The district, with migrant Muslim population of about 40%, has since turned into a no-go zone for law enforcement. It is true, there is a no-go zone in Brussels. There has been for years. And of course, quite a few people have just turned a blind eye to it, or, I mean, even after the Paris attacks, they still were in denial. Maybe now some are waking up to the grave danger. This website here says right after November's Paris attack, the German broadcaster, DW, dispatched a reporter to Molenbeek, this district in Brussels. And it says, brushing aside the concerns that Brussels suburb have turned into an Islamist hub. The reporter compared the place to a hipster bar. My first impression, it's quoting this reporter, my first impression is that there are many Muslims here in Mozambique. Many have decided to live here because they're surrounded by people of the same faith. It's similar to when hipsters live in certain parts of cities where there are lots of other hipsters. It's all about being part of a community, that's all. And it says at Legal Insurrection, this dimwit ignorance of the threat of radical Islam in Europe isn't funny anymore. It's now turning deadly. It's costing lives. And you still have these left-wing reporters who are talking about how it's just a hip community. They just want to be with friends and family. In fact, it's a place of refuge for these terrorists. The Observer had a pretty powerful piece today as well, or maybe it was from yesterday. Europe is again at war. This is an op-ed piece. And this writer here says, it's time to admit the event of Europe's problem with Islamic radicalism. It's not terrorism anymore, this writer is saying. It's a guerrilla war. That's what this has turned into. He says, it's happened again. Jihadists have struck in the heart of Europe, spreading terror while murdering dozens and maiming hundreds of innocents. Yesterday's coordinated attacks, this is written Wednesday then, talking about the Tuesday attack. Yesterday's coordinated attacks on Brussels have woken Europeans yet again to the threat that exists in their midst. A grave danger politicians seem to have no idea how to handle. That's what we see. The leaders in Europe, they just don't know what to do about this. I mean, there's the crackdown in the aftermath of all of the devastation. But outside of this, I mean, Europe's been transformed just in the, like it has said about Mozambique, there's other areas like that. And it's just been in the last decade and a half or two decades that they've brought in all of these threats. Belgium's a small country, it says, relative to population. This would be equivalent to 900 dead Americans and a staggering 7,800 wounded. It says, to say nothing of the symbolism of yesterday's attack on the metro near Malbeek, the Malbeek station in downtown Brussels, right next to the offices of the European Union, striking at the very heart of the European project, revealing its vulnerability to even a handful of ardent madmen, sends a powerful message that nobody can miss. People around the world in the West, the average citizen, they may still ignore these warning signs, but you can be sure that the leaders of the European project, they are taking note. Europe is in crisis. Yet another crisis among many. You look at the string of attacks. This article, The Observer, brings that out, going back to Madrid in 2004. That attack left nearly 200 people dead. And then, of course, there was the bombings in London the following year, 2005. And then look at last year, a brutal year for France. Two attacks in Paris. And through it all, this piece says, Belgium was left nearly unscathed. According to The Observer, the radicals appreciated the fact that they could live in an area with such lax security and plan attacks in other regions of the continent. I mean, why cause a fuss in Belgium when they can plan the attack in Mozambique and then head off to Paris or Madrid or wherever? Well, now they strike right at the heart of Europe, right in downtown Brussels, right next to the offices of the European Union. And the attack was moved up by several days because of this arrest that, as I mentioned yesterday, took 3 or 4 months just to find the guy. And he was a few months from his, or rather a few blocks from his house. Hiding in plain sight. The Observer says here, the game changer was last November's horrific attacks in Paris, the bloodiest events on French soil since World War II. These turned out to have a significant Belgian footprint, with several of the attackers linked to Molenbeek, a notorious Brussels suburb that's half Muslim and known to authorities as a hotbed of radicalism. Everyone knows, but no one knows what to do about it. It says, for the police, Molenbeek has been a no-go area of sorts for years, leaving jihadists free rein to raise funds, collect arms, and plot mayhem elsewhere. Think about that. Right near the main offices of the European project, and there they are, raising funds, collecting weapons, plotting terrorist attacks. It says it was thus no surprise that Molenbeek was where the police last week finally caught up with Salah Abdel Salam, the last of the Paris attackers still on the run. It was also no surprise that many Muslims in that community were less than supportive of the authorities in their efforts to find the wanted man. Mr. Abdel Salam has already been linked to yesterday's attacks, and their execution only 4 days after his capture hardly seems like happenstance. Here he is linked to another one. Then notice what the Observer has to say toward the end of the piece. It highlights where this is leading. Simply put, Europe has imported a major threat into its countries, one that did not exist a couple generations ago. This is a threat that just simply didn't exist. And now they've imported this. How do you suppose the nations in Europe are going to respond to this ongoing refugee crisis? Well, it's crying out for leadership. It needs the leader first. But the continent is beginning to wake up to the fact that it's imported this danger, this major threat, right into its own nations, right into the Union. The Observer writes, Europe is now at war again. The threat today is less terrorism than a low-grade insurgency, a guerrilla war of sorts that hangs over much of the continent as thousands of jihadists, made proficient killers by ISIS in Syria and Iraq, return home with visions of killing infidels, their former neighbors. So the war continues. They just move from somewhere in Syria or Iraq back to Molenbeek, back into Paris, back into Frankfurt. There will be no parley or negotiation with such mass murderers, it says. Parsing the death cult ideology that drives ISIS fighters with the hope of making it less noxious makes as much sense as trying to divine the finer political points of the Manson family. It says, we should expect more guerrilla-like attacks like Brussels yesterday, moderate in scale, relatively easy to plan and execute against soft targets, and utterly terrifying to the public. Utterly terrifying. At some point, angry Europeans, fed up with their supine political collapse, will begin to strike back. And that's when the really terrifying scenarios come into play. I mean, you can imagine that at some point, when angry Europeans rise up to strike back, it just takes this to another level. It gives a few examples of that as it's happened in history, recent history and recent decades. Then it says here, when the violence comes, a practically disarmed Europe will be all but powerless to stop it. To take the case of Belgium, at the Cold War's end, a generation ago, its army had 7 brigades and 18 infantry battalions, plus some 30 more battalions in reserve. Today, Belgium's army has only 2 brigades and 6 infantry battalions. some 3,000 bayonets in all. That tiny force would have trouble exerting control over even one bumptious Brussels neighborhood in the event of serious crisis. That tiny army would have trouble maintaining control of just one little neighborhood. This is the Europe today. It says later, after the Cold War, with the birth of the European Union, many Europeans believe they had achieved the end of history. Issues of war and peace had been settled. Henceforth, Brussels would debate nothing more worrisome than agricultural subsidies. But history has returned, as it always does. History has returned, as it always does. And when politics fail, violence follows, and violence on a large scale becomes war. See, this is one of several commentators now that's seeing this not just as random acts of violence. I mean, it was set for Easter Monday, but they bumped it up in response to the arrest of one individual last Friday. And now it's discovered there's all these other operations that are in the works. One of them in advanced stages that was foiled just last night north of Paris. When politics fail, violence follows, and violence on a large scale becomes war. It becomes war. And so Europe is crying out for leadership. Europe is desperately in need of a leader in a world where there's a huge leadership vacuum. Look at the United States. Look at how it's fighting this war. The U.S. has some troops, a few thousand, in Iraq to help the Iraqi forces in the fight against terrorism there. And just to highlight the impossible position that the United States is in, the Telegraph reported the other day that one of the deadliest Iranian-backed militias in Iraq has threatened to attack U.S. troops deployed fighting the Islamic State and to deal with them, these few troops in Iraq, to deal with them as occupying forces. And then the Telegraph notes this, the U.S. and the Shia militia are in theory on the same side against ISIS, and the threat underscores the complex web of alliances and antagonism among the forces fighting the jihadist movement. I mean, here the United States sends a few troops in to support the fight against ISIS in Iraq, and Iran sees that and says, well, we see it as a threat, and we're going to fight the American forces. This is the same nation we reached the nuclear agreement with on January 16th. The same nation that we're supposedly on the same side against in fighting against ISIS in Syria. What a vacuum of leadership. What a void of leadership. You look at what the United States is busy doing. I mean, what a week it's been with the president traveling to Cuba and apologizing, continuing with the apologizing, vowing to close down Guantanamo. It was discovered just, I guess this was in a testimony on Wednesday, that some of the terrorists that the Americans have released from Guantanamo have already, I mean, there have been many reports in recent months of them showing up on the battlefield. But there was testimony in front of Congress on Wednesday where a top American official admitted that some of these terrorists that have been let go have killed Americans. They've killed Americans. And of course, the thinking behind letting them go and shutting down Guantanamo is that, well, we just don't want for the terrorists to have that as a means to recruit new jihadists. Look at what they're doing to our boys in Guantanamo. They're torturing them. They're doing this. They're doing that. And so the way the administration views this, President Obama's administration, is that if we close this detention center down, it will help us to win over ISIS, to win over America's enemies. In fact, those prisoners have returned right to the battlefield, and they've already killed Americans. Let me just play you this exchange from the testimony. I think Lee Wolosky and Paul Lewis, I think, are the two testifying. And then you'll hear the congressman who really presses them hard on the closure of Guantanamo. This is a congressman, I believe, from California, Dana Rohrabacher.
Let me ask you this. We say that about 30% or whatever that figure is that have been released have returned to terrorist activities. How many lives have been lost by those terrorists who went back to their terrorist activity? How
Sir,
many
I can,
lives?
I can talk about that in a classified setting, but...
Classified?
Yes.
So is it over 10?
Sir, what I can tell you is, unfortunately, there have been Americans that have died because of Gitmo detainees.
How many Americans have to die? How many people in Brussels or Paris have to die, civilians? What's the threshold at that point? Well, maybe we will keep them under control in Gitmo.
Sir, when anybody dies, it's a tragedy, and we don't want anybody to die because we transfer detainees. However, it's the best judgment and the considered judgment of this administration and the previous administration that the risk of keeping Gitmo open is outweighed, that we should close Gitmo.
So the innocent people who are going to lose their lives because of this, they're just part of the equation.
No, sir, there are risks.
I'm sorry. I want to tell you this much. As far as I'm concerned, if one child is saved because she would have been blown up by someone who's being released, it's better to keep all 90 of those people in Gitmo. And this idea that the people of the world, they're so upset with us that it's a recruiting vehicle, that we've kept terrorists who murder innocent people in Gitmo. Well, you know what? I think that the bigger recruiting tool today is when our government, especially this administration, is perceived as being weak. I think terrorists are recruited not because we've held other terrorists in prison, but because we look like we're weak and cannot deal with the challenge. This disgusts me. Thank you very much.
That's true. There's just weakness everywhere that you look. They're given free rein in Molenbeek. The United States is not going after this enemy by any means. And even going so far as to close down Guantanamo, where there are hardened killers, terrorists, that have already killed Westerners, even Americans. And now, as you just heard, there's an open admission that, yes, some have returned to the battlefield, and some have even killed Americans. It wasn't revealed how many. But still, the whole facility has to be shut down because it's seen as a recruiting vehicle by the current administration of the United States. It helps ISIS to recruit more terrorists. How much farther can this go before an attack is so bold and audacious, so huge, so massive? I mean, they're already setting their sights on nuclear facilities, following nuclear scientists, videotaping them, videotaping their movements. I mentioned yesterday on the program a statement that President Obama had made earlier this week. I believe this is from Wednesday, when he was alongside the president of Argentina. And this is what he had to say about America's fight against radical terrorism.
Even as we are systematic and ruthless and focused in going after them, disrupting their networks, getting their leaders, rolling up their operations. It is very important for us to not respond with fear. As I said, that's hard to do because we see the impact in such an intimate way of the attacks that they make. But we defeat them in part by saying, you are not strong, you are weak. We send a message to those who might be inspired by them to say, you are not going to change our values of liberty and openness and the respect of all people.
He said, we defeat them in part by saying, you are not strong. Now, we're trying to disrupt their networks. We're trying to get their leaders. Where we put them when we get them is an open question. We're trying to roll up their operations. But it's important that we don't respond with fear, because we defeat them in part by saying, you're not strong. Of course, he caught a lot of flack a couple of years ago, was it, when he called ISIS the JV team. He's come out with some stronger language since. But think about a strategy of trying to defeat them in part by saying they're not strong, they're weak. And then meanwhile, you have Madrid in 2004. You have the London bombings in 2005. Leave aside all of the attacks that are ongoing in Israel, throughout the Middle East, the slaughter of Christians. I mean, these are the Western targets. 9/11 before Madrid. Spectacular success for the jihadists. Charlie Hebdo last year. Paris in November. Brussels on Tuesday. We said as early as 1993, 1994, we identified the King of the South. We said Iran would lead the radical Islamist movement. We were talking about this grave threat, certainly long before anyone else was, long before Molenbeek was radicalized. This is what we say in the booklet. He was right. As a result of this confusion in defining the enemy, the U.S. in the years since 2001 has effectively done nothing to target Iran or degrade its support of terrorism. The war on terror has actually left Iran stronger. Who can deny this? That they're now in a stronger position. They're fueling this hatred, this war. It is a war. They're no longer random acts of terror. This is guerrilla warfare that's playing out across Europe. And it's because the United States has been weak from the beginning. From the beginning of this so-called war against terror. A refusal even up front, even at the start, even after the worst attack in 2001, to even clearly identify the enemy. It says here, this is he was right, Iran has directed, funded, armed, and personally assisted in the Hamas and Hezbollah attacks that transformed Israel and Lebanon into battlegrounds. I mean, this was written before the emergence of ISIS a couple of years ago. But look at the news today of a few thousand American troops touching down in Iraq to help push back against ISIS. And instead of saying thank you, Iran says, you are a threat. You are an occupying force. You are the enemy. What does that tell you about Iran and ISIS and these attacks in Madrid and London and Paris and Brussels? In many ways, as my father has repeatedly pointed out, ISIS is a distraction. It's the bigger movement behind it that's never been confronted. And in fact, in recent years, the strategy has just been 100% appeasement. Give them what they want. It's been the approach all along leading up to the nuclear deal. It's the approach of this administration in general. You see it on a smaller scale in Cuba. Finishing this quote, it says, even if the U.S. had won a decisive victory in its campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, it would still be far from winning the war on terror. As long as the chief sponsor of Islamist terrorism, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is still in existence, the war on terror has not been won. It hasn't been won. So the U.S. sends troops now to help because everybody in the world agrees that ISIS is a brutal regime. And what happens when they land in Iraq? Well, the group fighting alongside the Iraqi army says the U.S. must withdraw. Or the militia, the Iran-backed militia, will deal with them as an occupying foreign force. It's pretty amazing. And it's building to Daniel 11 and verse 40. As we know, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him and the king of the north. That's the European power. That's the European combine. At the time of the end, the king of the south, so that's radical Islam, headed up by Iran, it shall push at him. Who? The king of the north. The U.S. is already out of the picture. That's what my father has said. That's why the United States, that's why Manasseh is not mentioned in this prophecy. The king of the south pushes at the king of the north. It pushes in Madrid. It pushes in Paris. It pushes in London. It pushes in Brussels now. What will happen when it finally strikes at Germany? This is something that Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg has been warning about. He said Germany so far has been lucky. It's been like Belgium. Belgium until Tuesday. The king of the south shall push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. You come back to this observer piece that I mentioned earlier. Europe's imported this major threat. And now it's at war again. I mean, after the Cold War, the birth of the EU, so many in Europe just believe that, well, we've reached the end of history. All the issues of war and peace, they've been settled. The Soviet Union has collapsed. Let's downsize our armies. Let's get rid of our weapons. Let's bring in all kinds of refugees. Let's import this major threat. And now look at Europe today. History has returned, as it always does. And when politics fail, violence follows. And like the Observer brings out, violence on a large scale becomes war. It becomes war. That's what's prophesied. That's what that is there in Daniel 11 and verse 40. That's full-scale war discussed in that prophecy, in that one verse. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall eventually come against him like a whirlwind. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. The live stream's available at the trumpet.com website and also kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
The prophet Daniel wrote about a future confrontation between a power in the north and the king of the south. We are now in the time when these two major powers are quickly rising. The king of the south is stirring up trouble even today. It is critical that you know the identity of this prophesied power. For more, request our booklet, King of the South. Visit thetrumpet.com and click the literature tab to select your free booklet.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Couple of emails that have come in here before we conclude with a short Bible study. This one I thought I'd read just because it was so complimentary of the newest program in our lineup, The Sun Also Rises. It says here, because of my current standing, I'm not entirely sure that further on it says, the show brings a lot to light a particularly beautiful gift that God seems to give in the form of Mr. Jacques' perspective and delivery. How amazing to see the explosion of fruitfulness as that gift goes from written format to the blessings in a radio delivery. The very first program fit right in with a string of lessons God has been weaving from programs you have given and other personal studies, as well as parallels in my own life. I was moved, it says, beyond words. That's coming from someone who loves Jeremiah Jacques' new program, The Sun Also Rises. This one here comes in response to the program we had last week on managing your time in the last hour. And she says here, I appreciated the action steps with the analogy about David. It was excellent reinforcement. As you were speaking, I was bringing to mind all kinds of things in the recent few weeks where Satan has tried to, quote unquote, help me in ways that really are actually a hindrance. It helped me see it more clearly and remove doubt. I needed the reinforcement. It was encouraging and strengthening to some decisions I've made where obviously I've had a little opposition from the world in the form of concern, quote unquote, concern. And then it says later on, it's amazing how powerful some right direction can be. Further on, thanks again for the program. It was very helpful. Now the hard job of shoring up our greatest time weaknesses. For me, needing time to psych myself up and sort out thoughts is definitely on that list. Feeling disoriented and mentally cluttered and giving in to that by taking more breaks or just pursuing the distractions rather than the priorities. So that's coming, as I say, in response to that show we had last week regarding managing your time in the last hour. Well, we are in the last hour, that time prophesied in Matthew 24 and Daniel 12, 2 Timothy 3, all these verses that we read so often on this program. And it is, as I said in that show on managing your time, it is, the times are so urgent that it should impact our way of life, our behavior, the way we think, the way we manage our time. the way we discipline ourselves. There's a verse or two verses in Galatians that talk about the fruits of God's Spirit. And one of them is the fruit of temperance. Temperance, that power that God makes available to us through His Holy Spirit that enables us to master self, to build discipline into our lives. We need it. Let's notice 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12 to begin with, and we'll just focus in on a few things we've said before here in recent programs, but from a little bit of a different angle here today. 1 Corinthians 6 and chapter 6 and verse 12, it says in the Moffat translation, "All things are lawful for me, yes, but not all are good for me. All things are lawful for me, yes, but I'm not going to let anything master me." Paul said, I've got to keep those bodily appetites under control. I don't want to let anything master me. I don't want to become addicted to something that really holds me back, as I covered yesterday, or serves as a weight to slow me down. I don't want to be brought under the power of sin. I don't want to be subdued by it. I don't want to become a slave to it. It says in verse 13, "Meats for the belly and belly for meats, but God shall destroy both it and them. Now the body is not for fornication, but for the eternal, and the eternal for the body." In other words, there's a right and lawful use for everything. That's basically what Paul's saying here. God didn't create the human body so that we could just go out and satisfy every carnal desire. He created the human body and mind for the Lord, it says. What is our purpose? Why are we here? What is this life for? It's a training ground for our future in the family of God. The physical body and mind, it was meant to house the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit. That's what it says in this very chapter, if you read through to the end. But skip over to chapter 9, 1 Corinthians 9, and verse 24, this analogy that Paul makes with running for the prize. He says, "Know you not that they which run in a race run all, but one receives the prize. So run that you may obtain. And every man that strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible." We're like athletes in training. We're like performers who are striving for perfection. And God says we've got to be temperate in all things. Temperance, one of the fruits of God's Holy Spirit. Herbert Armstrong wrote in an old article, "This is the life, real abundant living." He said, "To conduct this work, I lead a very busy, driving life and expend a great deal of energy. A physician friend of mine once asked me, 'Mr. Armstrong, I don't see how you do it. Where do you get this energy? How do you keep going so long and under so many hours of strain and stress and still have that driving energy?' He said, I told him, 'It's one of the resources that I get from above. It comes from God.' But then notice he says, 'Of course, I find it necessary to observe the laws of health and practice moderation in all things. It requires self-discipline.'" See, he had to also push himself. He had to drive himself to go after that source from above. Notice Philippians chapter 4. Again, this is also from Paul's writings. Philippians chapter 4, and we'll start in verse 3. It says, "And I entreat you also, true yoke fellow, help those women which labored with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and with other My fellow laborers, whose names are in the book of life, rejoice in the Lord always, it says. And again, I say rejoice. Let your moderation be known unto all men. The Lord is at hand. Let your moderation, your temperance, your balance, let it be known. In other words, set an example of someone who's truly balanced God's way. Moderation is a law. It's a principle of God's way of life. You can study through the Bible. The Proverbs is a good book to look at with respect to, you know, avoiding excess or addiction, to make sure that things are used or consumed in moderation, avoiding overindulgence. Let your moderation be known. Last week we referred to the verse in Matthew 5 where it says to become perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. You'll remember that quote from the leadership training series that I gave to you, talking about those who think that they're balanced because, well, they're also involved in this many hours with TV or socializing or shooting the breeze, go out shopping, a little bit of everything. And as that quote brought out, that standard of balance is the world's standard, not God's. I mean, if someone is balanced according to God's plan and purpose, according to God's truth, according to God's laws, the world is going to view it as very much out of balance. Notice what it says over in John 17. Switching to the Gospels here, John 17 and verse 11. It says, "And now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world, and I come to you, Holy Father," this is Jesus Christ's prayer at that last Passover. "Holy Father, keep through your own name those whom you've given to me, that we may be one as we are." It says, this is verse 14, "I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world." See, as I read last week, if we love the world, the love of the Father cannot dwell in us. Verse 16 here says, "They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world." Christ said he overcame the world. And he urged us, he admonished us to also overcome this world. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5 that we're ambassadors for Christ. We're his representatives on this earth, God's people, true Christians. And so we don't mingle with the affairs of this world, the political affairs, the wars between earthly kingdoms, or between nations. We're like ambassadors or diplomats who dwell on the earth right now in foreign nations. Except that the nation we represent is God's nation, the kingdom of God. There's a verse in Philippians 3 that says our citizenship is in heaven. And so that's who we look to. How frustrating would it be? You see the panic setting in among evangelicals or other groups, Mormons, whoever, in the United States in particular, I mean, with the oncoming presidential elections in November. As people in the traditional Christian world are panicking, are freaking out. How are we supposed to get so-and-so in office so that the whole country's not ruined? Who does God want to put in office? We've got to do our part. For God's people, their citizenship is in heaven. We're ambassadors or diplomats. We know where the real solution lies. We know that there's no hope in man. There's no hope in democracy or communism or socialism or any of the isms that man's created or come up with. Our hope, the solution for the problems of this world. It comes back to the kingdom of God, the establishment of God's government on this earth, the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. Let's conclude over in 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter 2, God's standard of balance is very much out of balance the way the world would view it. But in living a godly lifestyle, what a rewarding life it is, and how balanced it is between God and His work, between being productive and devoting time to family, building happy marriages, contributing to the congregation and even the community, letting our light shine, setting a fine example, letting godly moderation be known among all men. That's what it means to be balanced. God's way, godly balance. 1 Peter 2 and verse 9, it says, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation," it says, about God, His people, the true church, "a peculiar people." Peculiar people. I mean, they stand out in a peculiar kind of way. Let your light shine. Let your moderation be known. Now, some will view it and perhaps ridicule it or mock it. But many others, at least before it really turns bad, right before the return of Christ, many others will look at it and see it and admire it and even respect you for the fact that you don't compromise, that you stand up for God's laws, God's truth, that you put God first. A peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. Peter also talked about always being ready to give an answer of the hope that lies within you. I mean, these are beaming Christians, filled with light, striving for moderation in all things, godly balance, who are ready at a moment's notice to spring forth with an answer of the hope that lies within. He says here in verse 11, "Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul." God beseeches us as strangers and pilgrims. That's what true Christians are in this present evil world. As my father brings out in his booklet, The Epistles of Peter, we're just passing through. We're pilgrims on the way to the promised land. Our citizenship is in heaven. We're like those ancient Israelites, traversing their way through the wilderness, just passing their way through until their grand entrance into the promised land. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show as we wrap up another week of programming here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, broadcasting from our beautiful campus there in North Edmond, just off of Waterloo and Bryant. The live stream makes this available to you anywhere in the world that you have internet access. You can get that at thetrumpet.com or at the KPCG website as well. Over the weekend, won't you drop us a line? Send us an email to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us this week. And we'll see you next week.